On this episode of the Forgot Tonya Project, I am pleased to share a conversation with Marion Cornelius about the unbelievable history of Camp Ellis, a massive World War II army camp that was located right here in rural Forgot Tonya.
Forgot Tonya, like a lot of stated proposals, they felt like they were kind of being left out. If you look at a map of Illinois, there are a lot of freeways in Illinois, but Forgot Tonya didn't have the freeway they wanted. Well, they couldn't get that freeway built. We're going to create our own little state called Forgot Tonya.
Those of you from the area have no doubt heard of Camp Ellis. You've probably even spent some time driving by what remains of the Army camp today. Maybe you've driven by the old smoke chimneys, walked along the graffiti-laced rifle range, or maybe you've had the chance to visit Camp Ellis Days, the festival that occurs each year on Labor Day weekend in Ipava. But according to Marion Cornelius, the director of the Easley Pioneer Museum, which holds the largest collection of artifacts from Camp Ellis, there are quite a few misconceptions people have about Camp Ellis. To say Camp Ellis is massive is an understatement. As Marion will discuss, the camp was around 18,000 acres outside the small towns of Ipava, Table Grove, and Bernadotte. But since our conversation about Camp Ellis is so massive, we split this into two parts. This edition will focus more on the story of Camp Ellis, why it was built, just how big it was, and hopefully Marion will clear up some misconceptions people have about Camp Ellis. Marion has so much knowledge to share. He was a lot of fun to talk to. I should share that my students and I at Cuba High School had been planning a trip to visit Marion at the Easley Pioneer Museum. We had been doing some research of our own about Camp Ellis, but unfortunately that trip was canceled due to the recent pandemic. Our conversation, however, proved to be a helpful alternative to the trip and one that I'm excited to share. So could you start off by just sharing a little bit about yourself and the Easley Pioneer Museum?
Oh, there's a whole bunch there. There's not a whole lot about me that probably you want to record, but I'm 80. We started the museum in 2003, so we've been at it for about 17 years now. And I did several things during my life. I was a school teacher. I'm also a retired flight instructor. I worked at several different construction jobs, and then I already told you that I worked for the hammer factory. I didn't teach school the whole time. I quit two different times. Mm-hmm. Once worked 4 years at the hammer factory, and then I went back to teaching. And then one other time, my wife and I got silly and bought the lumberyard in industry. So we ran the lumberyard for several years, and we weren't making a lot of money at that, as most lumberyards in this part of the country weren't. So I went back to school teaching again, and God, I did, because now I'm a retired school teacher, and teacher retirement is okay with me. The museum we started in 2003. Have you seen pictures of the museum?
Yes, I've seen pictures, and I saw one of those episodes of Illinois Stories that you're featured on.
So you know a little bit about what it looks like. Well, the museum started with the schoolhouse. It's called Freeman School, and Freeman School didn't set there always. Freeman School started, Freeman School was built in the 1870s, and it was about 5 miles southwest of Ipava. And we call it Easley Pioneer Museum. When we moved the school there and started the museum, we called it Easley Pioneer Museum because there's a guy named John Easley who is considered the father of Ipava. And John Easley came to Fulton County. There's a long story there that we can get into another time, but he came to Fulton County in 1836, and he ended up buying 160 acres, and he built his log cabin in the middle of the 160 acres, and the reason he's called the father of Ipava is that In the 1840s, then he started subdividing his farm and laying off lots, and he's the one that started IPAVA. Okay. And I'm not an Easley, but my wife is. So there's a lot of Easley history around the southern part of Fulton County. A lot of people who live in that area are related to the Easleys. And so that's how we came up with the name Easley Pioneer Museum, because it all started with the pioneer movement that came to this portion of the state during the 1830s and 1840s. And the school sat right on the corner of the property where my wife was raised, on the corner of that 160 acres. And because of that school, when the school closed in 1947, right after the war, that was the year that Vermont, IPAVA, and Table Grove consolidated into VIT. And so the school was closed, and shortly after it was closed, it got sold to a farmer about 2 miles away, and he moved the school and used it as a garage for 55 years. And it was in pretty bad shape, and I knew that the farmer was going to tear it down, so my wife's brother, his name is Ron Easley. He was here visiting one day, and I said to him, if you want to see that place where you used to go to grade school, why, probably we ought to go out and take a look at it, because I think the guy's going to demolish it. So we went and looked at it, and there's a long story that goes along with Ron Easley. He is the major contributor to the museum, and I won't get into that at this point in time. But after we looked at it, and he got home, was Washington, D.C. for him. And after he got back home, he called me up and he said, go see if you can buy that school. So to shorten the story up a little bit, I asked the guy if he'd sell it, and he said, no, I don't want to sell it. But if you want it, you can have it if you just get it out of here. So that's how we got the school. Is I said, well, that was in the fall. I said, I can't move it till spring. He said, oh, that's fine. So we ended up going to IPAVA, and there was a log cabin on the lot right next to where IPAVA High School used to sit that had been refurbished by a longtime mayor of IPAVA. And we find out that we're pretty certain that that log cabin was the first school in IPAVA. We can't prove that completely, but we're pretty sure that's what it was. So we ended up buying the lot with the log cabin on it, and the lot next door was empty, so we bought that lot. We bought the two lots and moved the school to the empty lot, and we were just about ready to pour the foundation to move the school when a tornado came through IPAVA. The cabin had sat there since 1841, and it demolished the cabin.
Oh, wow.
So the way it worked, I could number about 80% of the logs from the log cabin. I did that and hauled all the logs home and put them in my machine shed on the farm. And so then we decided, at first we were going to leave the log cabin like it was and build a museum building behind the school. So after the cabin blew down, we decided to build a bigger museum building and put the reconstruct the log cabin inside the museum. So the when you're looking at the pictures, the big building with the blue roof, that's where the front room of that building is, where the log cabin is, and I'm about maybe 25% along with rebuilding it in there. Mm-hmm. We built the front room a little taller to put the cabin in. Then first we moved the school before we built the building, though. We moved the school, and I got it about 90% finished before I started building the new building.
Yeah.
And so that's how the museum got started. My wife went to the school in that school. My wife and her two brothers, her mother and her father went to school in that school. Her grandfather and grandmother went to school in that school. And her great-grandfather helped build it. And her great-grandfather was a man named Oscar Easley. Oscar Easley was on the square in Vermont when Abraham Lincoln spoke in Vermont. And there's quite a bit of history to Oscar. And Oscar married Amy Freeman, and the school is named Freeman School after Amy Freeman's father, because he's the one that donated the land for the school to be built on in the first place.
Okay.
So now we're kind of a little more up to date.
Share how long you've had the Camp Ellis exhibit and just the story behind that.
Okay, when we got the museum building built, originally we were going to rebuild the log cabin in there. It was going to be just a pioneer museum of the old time history, and we hadn't any more and got started, and people started asking me questions about Camp Ellis, and I said, well, we really hadn't planned to do Camp Ellis, and before that got very far, Dr. Michael Wyatt from the Dixon Mounds Museum came to visit and wanted to know if we were going to do something about Camp Ellis, and I said, well, probably we will. All I know about Camp Ellis is that I grew up in Ipava, and I know quite a bit about the camp, but at that point I didn't know a great deal. And he said, well, this would have been when I was talking to him, was probably about 2004, and somewhere back in I can't remember what year now for sure, it was the mid-90s, I think 95 or 96, Dixon Mounds did a historical review of Camp Ellis, and it was quite extensive. And he said that we have these 29 plaques that we did, and probably not your students, but your students' parents probably saw these 29 plaques at Dixon Mounds, because they had it up. They had the Camp Ellis display up for about 6 months. And when it was over, they took the display down, and the display that they had took them a tremendous amount of time to build. The 29 plaques they're about 30 inches by 36 inches, and it's a pictorial history of Camp Ellis, about how it was built, what they did, after the people were trained at Camp Ellis, what they did. And it's really good. People who are really interested in learning as much as they can about Camp Ellis, when they get to those 29 plaques, they spend several hours with it, because there's that much information there. If you want to spend a lot of time to find all the information that's there about Camp Ellis, I've had several authors who have written books about Camp Ellis. When they come, there are three different ones that have been there, and they usually spend 3 or 4 days.
Wow.
So that gives you a little insight onto how much information is available. Dr. Wyatt, he said, we've got these 29 plaques. We can't give them to you, but if you're going to have a display about Camp Ellis, we'll bring them and you can display them. And so I said, that's great. So when we finished that room, the very first thing that went in were those 29 plaques. And it just keeps growing all the time. In fact, it grew to the point where, it was about probably about 2015 that Ron Easley was here for another visit, and he looked at what we were doing. He said, we need to add on to the building. So when you look at a current picture of the building, there are three portions to the building. The front is the tallest, and then there's a middle section, and then the back section's a little taller than the middle section, but not as tall as the front section. Well, yeah. That back section was our addition. We added that on about 2014 or 15, and that made us quite a lot more room. And that room, we've got room to have groups of people and seated and show films and do that sort of thing too.
Oh, that's great. Can you share where exactly Camp Ellis was around you in Ipava, and how big was it?
Okay, Camp Ellis. Usually, what I tell people when we're looking at a map in the museum, I've got several maps. There's one big one on the wall, and when you look at it, the south boundary of Camp Ellis is right at the edge of what is now Route 136, on the north side of 136. At the time it was built, it wasn't Route 136, it was Route 10. And one of the things people don't realize is how far back it was with Camp Ellis is that the concrete highway that was built and then the name changed to Route 136. Camp Ellis was built about, it's pretty close to 6 years after they poured the concrete. So paved roads were a new thing at that point. And Camp Ellis started in January 1942. February 7, 1941, your students probably all know the Day of Infamy, Pearl Harbor. That was when Camp Ellis was put on the front burner. Camp Ellis, the earliest plannings that I've read about Camp Ellis happened in 1935, and they planned to make a camp of about 100,000 acres, and it was to be a camp not to train people to fight, but to train support people for those who are fighting the war. At that point in time, the United States didn't have a camp to train support people. They just kind of trained them here and there and everywhere and not a particular camp. So most people think that Camp Ellis was built to train people to fight the war, and that's not really true. It was built to train support people. Now, back to size. Camp Ellis, starting with Route 136, and that 136 runs between Ipava and Table Grove. The west side of Camp Ellis goes right up really close to the east side of Table Grove. The east side of Camp Ellis goes further east than Ipava. The camp basically is 5.5 miles north to south, and 6.5 miles east to west. And when you get to reading about the history, it gets kind of confusing because the early things you read, it talks about a camp that was 8,000 acres. And that was true. When they first came in, what they did, the way I explain it, is they took the land from the farmers in what I call three different land grabs. The first land grab was about 8,000 acres. And it was the place where they built the city. Another thing to throw in here that it took me a long time to figure out is that, and I didn't figure this out till about 4 years ago, when Camp Ellis was built and going, it was the second largest city in Illinois. Only Chicago was bigger. It was bigger than Peoria, bigger than Springfield, bigger than the Quad Cities.
Oh, wow.
So it was really a large place. So the first land grab was the flat land that lays along Route 136, and they took that 8,000 acres, and that's where they built all the buildings. The second land grab was another approximately 8,000 acres to the north, and it's in the rough country and included part of Spoon River, and that was the training area for the camp.
Yeah.
In fact, in the very northwest corner of that training area, later, probably in, I think it was probably about late 43, they built a thing called the German Village. And they built a little German village with houses and buildings like you might find in a German village in Germany, mm-hmm. in order to help with the training of the people there. I've left out of what I'm saying here. I should have said a little bit earlier that when they're training support people, they had three different groups of support people. Okay. They trained engineers, quartermasters, and now I'm 80 years old and there's a blank in my mind right there.
Like hospital wards or?
Yeah, they trained engineers, quartermasters, and, hospital people, yeah. Medical people. Okay. Sometimes my old mind doesn't work like it should. So those three were the main groups that were that were trained at the camp. And after they got the camp up, and actually it was started and running, and the people at the hospital, they called it the station hospital. And maybe I should say something about the station hospital. The station hospital was about a little over a mile northwest of Ipava. It was really pretty close to Ipava.
Right.
And the station hospital, for all of the people that you have in your classes, they're familiar with St. Francis Hospital in Peoria. Mm-hmm. And if you consider just the downtown hospital of St. Francis, not all the outlying areas they have, but the downtown hospital at St. Francis, the station hospital in 1943, 4, and 5 was larger than St. Francis Hospital in Peoria is today.
Right. Wow.
It was huge. It was a huge place. And one of the things that I include in the talk when I'm talking to people mm-hmm. is that as they got this hospital going, they realized what they were up. By that point, they realized what they were up against in the war, especially the war in Europe. And they needed, in order to save lives, they need to have hospitals in different places. And there's quite a display there that tells about how they did this that's in the museum. And when you see that display of what they did was they would train complete surgery units. Hmm. And they realized right away they need to be able to travel with those surgery units. So the third land grab was approximately 3 square miles on the very east side of the camp to build an airport. And they built an airport, and as soon as they got it built, they brought airplanes in so they could transport the hospital units. And the building the airport was quite a deal, and there's quite a bit about that. The engineers at the camp built the airport. They built two runways. Both runways were about a mile long, which was a long runway in those days, this being 1943. The idea was they needed to get C-47s in. A C-47 is a... for those that don't know about airplanes, is a twin-engine tail dragger. It doesn't have a nose wheel. It has a tail dragger. They were piston engines, but they were the workhorse of World War II. And so they needed to get C-47s in, so the engineers built a runway in 23 hours.
Oh, wow.
We have an example of the mat that they use. It's a steel mat, and it's in the museum so that your people can see that. The steel mat, each mat is about 2 feet wide and about 12 feet long and probably weighs about 150 pounds. I carried it in. That would have been about 14 years ago that I carried it in to put it on display. I carried it in by myself. The guy brought it to me.
Yeah.
But I couldn't carry it today. that was before I got to be 70 years old.
Yeah.
and they're pretty heavy. But the point of that is the runway was 250 feet wide and 5,280 feet long.
Wow.
And the engineers laid all of that mat in 23 hours.
Wow. Wow.
And there's more to that story, but I won't go any further than that. that. But my idea of telling that here is that was the third land grab for those 3 square miles to catch you. Now, that gets you caught up to date as to, you asked me how big the camp was. It ends up being approximately 19,600 acres. So it's 5.5 miles north to south, 6.5 miles east to west, and but those are not straight lines. They're, when they bought the land, they've got several corners in it. But that gives you the basic size of the camp.
Right. How did the locals feel about Camp Ellis?
When they got finished with all the land grabs, mm-hmm. in the 19,600 acres, that displaced 150 families. So there were 150 wow. farm families that lived out there that had to leave, and they had to leave quickly. Yeah. And that's another story. Dean talked about it a little bit in that video that you saw. Mm-hmm. Kind of what it amounted to, and this started in February of 1942. If you were living there, some stranger in a suit came to your house and knocked on the front door. Well, anybody that lives in the rural areas around here knows that the backdoor guests are best. A guy in a suit knocking on the front door, that's not a good thing. But you got to knock on the front door, and the guy introduces himself, and he hands you a sheet of paper, and the top of the sheet of paper was a legal description of your farm, and they're telling you that they're confiscating your farm. In other words, the land's been condemned, mm-hmm. and you have 30 days. You have to be out in 30 days. You can take your house, you can take your barn, you can take your cows, you can take your corn, take anything that belongs to you. All they want's the dirt. So you have to be out in 30 days, and in 30 days they're going to come along, and anything that's left is going to be bulldozed down and demolished. Mm-hmm. And these are farms of third and fourth generation people who have been living on this land. So this was a pretty tough thing, pretty hard for those farmers. So Dean Chenoweth, who you saw, he's one, and he was, when they did that, he was 7, I think.
Yeah.
And he's 85 now, I think it is. But there were 150 of those families. Oh, I missed one part. At the bottom of the sheet of paper was the amount of money you were going to be paid for your farm. Mm-hmm. But the guy would say to you as soon as he gave you the sheet that this is what you're going to be paid, but we have no idea when you're going to get your money.
Oh, my goodness.
So if you want to be a farmer, you're going to have to go buy another farm, and you don't have any money to buy it with.
Yeah.
And another thing to remember that I remind people when we talk about this is before television. Computers yeah. weren't even heard of. There were telephones, but telephones and newspapers and magazines, that was it.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like the story I told you earlier about Chicago being in Fulton County.
Yeah.
And it was hard to get from Chicago to Lewistown. And the same thing is true in 1941-42, too. Travel is difficult. And almost all travel is by train.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a difficult job. Okay, that kind of leads me into the camp itself as they were building, I call it the city. As they were building the city, they yeah. built 2,200 buildings in 13 months. Wow. And because this was happening all over the United States, there were Air Force bases and Army camps popping up everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, most people know about Rosie the Riveter. All the guys were joining the service, and the women were going to work to build machines. Well, building materials were hard to come by, and that's one of the reasons that Camp Ellis doesn't exist today, really, is because it was built. I think they built it, probably figured it was going to be permanent, but all the buildings were not permanent buildings. They were all frame buildings. Nothing was built out of brick except the chimneys.
Hmm.
And so they built 2,200 buildings in 13 months. One of the statistics that goes along with this that's kind of interesting is one of the first things they did was build a railroad spur from the east side of Table Grove into the camp about a mile and a half to a place that they called the warehouse area, and yeah. They built the warehouses first and then started building the rest of the buildings. They had about 7 or 8 different tracks that they could park trains on. They averaged 100 boxcar loads a day for 13 months.
Jeez.
In order to get all the building materials in there.
A lot of folks have the misconception about, just misconceptions about the camp in general. And one of the biggest ones is that it was just the prison camp, right? And so watching the show.
That's probably the biggest misconception.
Yeah.
The second biggest misconception. First one being that most people thought they were training people to fight the war, and that's not really true. If you came there as a recruit, mm-hmm. you did get trained to know how to fight, know how to defend yourself, but they weren't training you to fight. You were going to be an engineer or a medical person, quartermaster, which I call that cooks and bottle washers. That's what you trained to be, but you did get training in order to be able to defend yourself. So there were rifle ranges and different training areas all over the rest of the camp outside of the city part.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first misconception, that it wasn't a training camp to train people to fight. The second misconception was that the camp was built for prisoners of war, and actually the prisoner of war thing was just an afterthought. As they were ending up the 13 months of building the camp, as they were finishing the last set of buildings,
mm-hmm.
we were discovering that as a nation, we were discovering that we got a bunch of prisoners of war, and the first large bunch came from Rommel's troops out of North Africa.
Mm.
And so we got a bunch of prisoners of war, and we don't have any place to put them. The only place they had to put them was on empty ships, because we would have ships going over there taking materials over there to fight the war and coming back empty.
Yeah.
So they started putting the prisoners on the empty ships, and when they got here, they had to do something with them.
Yeah.
So what do you do with them? Well, you got to build a place to put them if you don't have a place to put them. And one of the places that the building was going on was Camp Ellis. So the last set of buildings that they built was the prisoner of war camp. And I said it was kind of just an afterthought, to give you kind of an idea of what's going on as far as prisoners of war are concerned. Most people that visit the museum, when I tell them this, their mouth hangs open. They don't quite understand.
Mm-hmm.
But there were prisoners of war housed in 9 different places in the state of Illinois and 47 different places in the immediate Midwest, right close around us.
Okay.
The prison camp at Camp Ellis just happened to be, it ended up being the largest one that I know of. There,
mm-hmm.
there was no other one place where they housed as many as they did at Camp Ellis. And how many did they house? It's really kind of hard to tell from the history that I've read.
Okay.
An exact number of just how many were there. It's somewhere around 4,000 at one time. The compound that they built for the prisoners would hold about 4,000 people. Near as I can tell from everything that I've read, there were probably somewhere between 7,000 and 8,000 different prisoners of war here during the whole period of time, but not more than 4,000 or so at one time. Another thing that's kind of interesting about the prisoners of war, if this was a minimum security prisoner compound,
mm-hmm.
so that if when you came here, they put you through some testing, and if they found out that you, as a prisoner of war, were a hardcore Nazi prisoner, you got taken to a maximum security place. You left Camp Ellis. If you were not, you're just an ordinary German soldier, then you stayed at Camp Ellis. Mm-hmm. And people like to know that the history around here of the German prisoners of war is pretty extensive in outlying areas away from the camp. They took them a lot of places to do a lot of things. In one January, there was a severe ice storm. I think it was 44 that they had a severe ice storm, and they took prisoners of war out to all the surrounding communities to help cut up down trees and repair from the ice storm. Back up a little bit. One of the interesting things about Camp Ellis that kids really get a kick out of, even younger kids and grade school kids, when they built the camp, it was just a terrible rainy year. It was just loblolly mud everywhere. And it was so bad that people really didn't understand what was going on. Mm-hmm. And this led into what I was about to say about prisoners of war. One of the big things they did was, because of all the rain and the loblolly of mud, and there was a time they took prisoners of war to the Illinois River and the Mississippi River to sandbag the floods. There's a map that you can see. You can usually find this map on the internet from time to time. If a guy was trained at Camp Ellis, and let's say he ended up in France, he's a engineer, and he's running a bulldozer in France, and he meets a guy from another company, and one of the things that Army people often do is, where'd you get your training? And I've had veteran after veteran that's told me this, that they were trained at Camp Ellis, and when they got to Europe, somebody ask them that question, where'd you get your training? And they'd say Camp Ellis. And everybody looked dumbfounded. Nobody knew where Camp Ellis was. But the loblolly of mud was so well known that somehow it got changed. The name got changed from Camp Ellis to Swamp Ellis. S-W-A-M-P, Swamp. And these guys are telling me when they get back then, the veterans, when they get back to the museum and they're seeing this, that, we would tell them we're from Swamp Ellis, and everybody knew where Swamp Ellis was.
That's awesome. I never knew that. So we decided to stop right here to conclude part one of our conversation with Marion Cornelius, the director of the Easley Pioneer Museum. This episode focused on the general history of Camp Ellis and the Easley Pioneer Museum, which hosts many artifacts from the camp. We also clarified some misconceptions that people often have about Camp Ellis. Let's quickly recap some major points from this episode. Camp Ellis is about 18,000 total acres in size, and this land was seized by the government in three major land grabs, which displaced about 150 families who were given 30 days to leave. 2,200 buildings were put up in 13 months, but little remains from them today. They weren't permanent structures. And two big misconceptions remain about the camp that often confuse people. The first misconception is that Camp Ellis was primarily built to train soldiers to fight. That's not true. It was mostly to train supporting soldiers, to train them for three primary supporting roles, that of quartermasters, engineers, or hospital wards. And the second misconception was that the primary purpose of Camp Ellis was to house German POWs, but as Marion said, housing the POWs was more of an afterthought. And finally, as Marion closed this part of the conversation, he shared that it was so rainy during the early days of Camp Ellis that many veterans referred to the camp as Swamp Ellis, so they actually knew it more as Swamp Ellis than they did Camp Ellis. Next time, we're going to conclude our talk with him by discussing the history of African American soldiers at Camp Ellis. This is a popular question that he's been fielding a lot lately. He'll also discuss notable visitors to the museum. And my favorite part of our conversation is what Marion feels is the legacy of the camp, why he thinks we should remember Camp Ellis. If you have any questions or comments for Marion about Camp Ellis, please don't hesitate to comment on our webpage, forgottoniaproject.com. You'll also find some resources on our post, such as the link to the episode of the show, Illinois Stories, that featured Marion and Camp Ellis, and that we referenced a few times in our talk. I'd encourage you, follow the Easley Pioneer Museum's Facebook page. They've been posting some outstanding videos lately about the camp's history, so you want to check that out. And of course, hopefully soon, when the museum opens back up, you can make the trip out yourself to visit Marion in person. In the meantime, if you'd like to hear from him directly, feel free to email Marion at pmcorn@mtcnow. That's pmcorn@mtcnow. And I'm sure he'd be happy to get back with you. So signing off for now, and thanks for listening to the Forgottonia Project podcast.